All right. It's good to be with you all here this afternoon. For those of you who don't know, my name is Mr. Jenkins. You can call me Billy if you'd like. That's fine. I want to make sure that you know you are allowed to ask any questions at any time during this. And I will be asking for your input for this also, so I don't want you to be falling asleep after lunch here. I know this is nap time for most of you, right after you've eaten. I also don't want to repeat too much of what's already been said. Since I wasn't here, I don't know for sure. So if we get into something that sounds a little too familiar, you can stop me and say you know this already. I'm supposed to speak to you on Thomas Aquinas and the natural law. So let's start with this. How many of you know who Thomas Aquinas was? Not quite half of you. And one of you sort of in the middle. Okay. For those of you who know who he is, tell us a little bit about him. Anyone, don't be shy. About when did he live? Let's start with that.
Yeah, like the medieval time.
Okay, that's a pretty broad answer, but 13th yes.
13th century.
Okay, 13th century. Who said that? Okay, good. The 13th century. He was a Dominican priest, okay. Does anybody know, and this is really the big question for what we're going to do today, does anybody know who one of the chief influencers of his thought was? It was a philosopher. Summer?
Aristotle.
Absolutely. And actually, throughout his writings, he calls Aristotle the philosopher, as if there was no other one who was worth his time to some degree. Okay. So we know a little bit about Thomas. What about the natural law? Has anybody heard of that before? Does anybody have any ideas as to what it is? Blank stares, that's a good thing. All right, well, here we go. Let's talk about law first a little bit. What do you think of when you think of law?
Like rules that we have to follow?
Rules, okay. And what rules do you think of specifically when it comes to
Ten Commandments?
Okay, good. So you have some idea of laws as something you need to obey, something you need to follow. Okay, that's a good one. Any other answers on that? Okay, well, William has hit on one, maybe even two of the types of law that we could think of. The first one being just your simple rules. The laws that are passed by your Congress, by your state legislature. These are called positive laws, statutory laws. You also have the laws you have to follow in your school or in your house. How many of you go to a school that has a dress code or have been to schools that have dress codes? Okay. These are rules you have to follow, man-made rules. Positive law. Okay, so we'll start with that. Then, William, you mentioned the Ten Commandments. What we might call supernatural law or eternal law. Okay, those laws which are contained in religious texts that are written down for us to follow. We might call a third law, a divine law, the law, the rule, the order by which God has made and rules over the universe. So what is the natural law then? How do we differentiate it from all these other kinds we've mentioned so far? Let me give you a little bit of an example. How many of you have read C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity? Nowhere near enough of you. All right. That needs to change when you go home. You need to get Mere Christianity and you need to read it. Okay. In the early parts of that book, Lewis makes an argument. He talks about a man who has an orange. And he's peeling it. You can sort of see him sitting out on a bench out in the city somewhere. He's peeling an orange. He's getting ready to eat it. And another person comes over and basically says, "Give me some of your orange." And then he tries to forcibly take it. And the man who had the orange in the first place gets upset. "Why are you taking my orange from me?" Now let's take it a step further. Lewis doesn't say this. What if the man who wanted the orange and didn't have it came up and punched him? Would that man who had the orange in the first place consider it wrong? Yeah, he would. But It's not because stealing an orange breaks U.S. Penal Code 641, even though it does. You're not allowed to do that. That's not why he would consider it wrong. Why does he consider it wrong? And why is he able to yell back to the person, "You can't have it"? It's because he's appealing to a sense of justice and a sense of order that both parties already know. They know it somewhere deep within themselves. It's unspoken. You know it too. If I came up to Victor and I punched him in the face right now, everybody would know it's wrong, and not because it's illegal to assault someone. There's something deeper there. I'm not allowed to injure another person in that way. He would probably get up and try and punch him back, but I wouldn't let him come faster than he is. And he would feel right. He would feel somewhat right to do that. Because a sense of justice has been offended. A sense of a law has been broken. A law that we don't have to speak in order to know. St. Paul talks a little bit about this natural law, even though he doesn't actually call it that. He does it in his letter to the Romans. And I know Mr. Hopes talked to you a little bit about Romans this morning in one of your classes. But in Romans chapter 1, Paul makes the argument that all men, even those who are never affiliated with ancient Israel, those who haven't heard the gospel to this day, are inexcusable before God because God has revealed how?
In the creation.
In the created order. Absolutely. God is revealed there. So all men are inexcusable. But he goes a step further in chapter 2 of the letter to the Romans. How many of you have ever read all of Romans? Nowhere near as many as should it. Okay. Romans chapter 2. In the 14th verse, Paul writes this. Even Gentiles, okay, so those who weren't Israelites, weren't Hebrews, even Gentiles who do not have God's written law, supernatural law, which we talked about, even those who don't have his written law, show that they know his law when they instinctively obey it, even without having heard it. This is that law I was talking about that Victor and I would know about, or the person who was trying to steal the orange would know about. There are laws that we know, that all human beings know, without ever having been instructed in it, whether by supernatural law, some kind of direct revelation from God, or whether it be from the rules of a state, of a government, there are laws that we already know they're in place which are natural, which we're not allowed to offend, and which we know within ourselves we are supposed to keep. The question sort of becomes, why? Even those who were not believers, according to Paul, obeyed the laws that God made for their own good. And they didn't do it by accident. They instinctively knew those laws. It's written within our hearts to live this way because there's a certain end. We use sort of a fancy word, a certain telos, to which each human being is pointed, and which we are supposed, and where we're supposed to try to get to. The natural law takes into account that there is an order to the universe and that all things have an end, or what we might call a purpose. Let me give you two examples to make this clear. All things have an end or a purpose. Just so you know, we're going to talk a bit about sex in this talk. So I hope that doesn't bother any of you. When animals reach mating season, what happens? What's that?
They mate.
They mate. All right. They make baby whatever species there are. They are, right? Okay, so someone pick an animal. Pick any animal.
Deer.
What's your name?
Nick.
Nick. Oh, my gosh. You got big. Okay. Continue. She's that tall. All right. I don't know all that much about deer. I'm not a hunter or anything, but when a female deer, when a doe, reaches the point where it's mating season, a male comes along, do they not? All right, and they copulate, and a pregnancy occurs, and a baby deer is born. Okay? So there's a natural end to the sexual activity. It's pretty predictable. If it's mating season, sex is had, a baby comes out of that. It's the natural order of things. The acorn, let's take that for example. What does an acorn become? An acorn tree? What does an acorn become? Does anyone know? The oak tree. Okay. Now, as I was researching a little bit for this, you'd be surprised at how fascinating the acorn actually is and how many creatures rely on the acorn to live. It's not just squirrels. Acorns are a great source of nutrition for a large variety of animals, wild, farm, and otherwise. But yes, uninterrupted, the acorn is going to develop into the mighty and wonderful oak tree. Okay? If it falls off of a tree, gets down into the dirt at the right level, is watered properly with the rains, it is in time going to grow into this wonderful work of God, this wonderful, magnificent tree. It's its natural end. Bound up within that tiny acorn is the potential for a mighty tree. Okay? And that's its end goal, its purpose, its telos, is to become the tree. In the same way, we can understand that as humans, there's an end toward which we are ordained to go. Orthodox Christians actually describe this as the predestinations of God. That we are predestined for a certain goal, a certain union with the Father by the time our lives are over. The problem with us, as opposed to the acorn, is that the acorn doesn't have a will, and we do. And therefore, we have to make sure that our wills cooperate with what our natural end is supposed to be. So let's talk about that for just a moment. What is the end of man? What is keeping the natural law supposed to get us to? What destination is it supposed to get us to? What state is it supposed to get us to? What is our chief end? Maybe no.
To be with God?
Good. Absolutely, that's a part of it. The Westminster Shorter Catechism has a great answer to this question. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and to enjoy Him forever. And to be with Him is certainly a part of that, Summer. We are, that is what we're destined for. To glorify God and to continue to enjoy Him. Now, Thomas doesn't use this language when he speaks of the natural law. He speaks of our natural end in a related way, but as pursuing that which is good. So what we have to do then is bring our wills into conformity with doing that which is good. This brings us to our discussion of natural law in its sort of outline form that Aquinas gives it. Does anyone know what Aquinas' great works are? He has two. One which is probably a little bit more famous than the other. Okay. The Summa. All right. And chapter 94, he really starts to hammer on the principles and precepts of natural law. The chief principle here, depending on which translation you use, avoid or shun evil and do good. That's the chief principle of natural law. It's all fine and good I suppose, as a definition, but what are the goods which Aquinas is talking about? Listen to what he said. All the things to which man has a natural inclination are naturally apprehended by the reason as good, and therefore to be pursued. Listen to it one more time. All the things to which man has a natural inclination are naturally apprehended by the reason as good, and therefore to be pursued. Does that strike anybody as possibly having any problems associated with it? And if so, what would they be?
Is it kind of like saying if there's something that you feel that is natural for you to do, you should do it?
Even if...
no matter what.
Okay. So, sometimes the things we feel, and that's a good way of putting it, like, the things that we feel we should do run up against what we would call the supernatural law. The things which we're naturally inclined to do don't always match up with the laws God has revealed to us. So, what is Thomas then getting at? Glad you asked. We'll go on from here then. Not sinful inclinations. Thomas didn't say, whatever you feel like doing, you ought to do. Feelings will lead you astray quite often. And we know that we are corrupted to some degree, and so that we're going to have, to use sort of classical terminology, passions. That is, desires. Which are not just things that we shouldn't be feeling. Those aren't the inclinations which he's talking about here. Those aren't the natural inclinations that are apprehended by our reason as good. The natural inclinations, which is what we're going to talk about here with the precepts, are the things which not only all humans share, and activities that all humans do, but activities which the rest of the natural world, the animal kingdom, which all other substances, what they do, what do we share in common with them? What does our reason tell us of what they do that is good? Here is precept number one. We are to preserve life and prevent its destruction. Humans, as well as animals and all other substances that are created, that are alive, do what they have to do to survive. Think of a couple of examples of this. If you're on a balance beam, have any of you done gymnastics? Okay, Danielle, you're shaking your head, or nodding your head. You've done gymnastics. Have you walked on a balance beam before? Done that thing where you have to do the backwards handstands and stay on that thing that's really narrow. Okay, but you know what? Okay, all right, but that's fine. You know that thing. When you start to teeter off of it, what do? If you're falling off to the right, your left if you're looking at me, what do? Yeah, Shane's doing it. You jerk back this direction. Why? Because we have an instinct to stay on the balance beam. Now imagine there isn't a 6-inch thick pad to catch you when you fall. Imagine you're that lunatic who tried to walk across Niagara Falls and then across the Grand Canyon. Can anyone see that? Anyone watch that? Okay. I mean, it's great that he prayed the whole way across, but I mean, at some point you have to wonder how much you should tempt God by doing something like that. When he fell, I didn't see the Niagara Falls, but I watched him walk across the Grand Canyon. And every time a gust of wind would come and shake his balance, or maybe if his concentration just broke for a split second and he tilted one way or the other, he immediately balanced himself again. Because he has an instinct for life. I don't know if any of you have ever experienced suicide among your friends or
or family. I hope you haven't.
I have. And my friend Tim, who struggled with severe bouts of depression on occasion, he rode his car up onto a set of train tracks and waited to be hit. And it was absolutely horrifying. And being at his funeral was one of the, and the viewings before his funeral were one of the worst experiences I've ever had. And it's because there was a common sensation there that everybody was feeling, that there was something extraordinarily unnatural that's happened, because we all have an understanding that we try to preserve life. And it's almost unfathomable that someone would get to the point where they want to take their own life, because we have, and we share with the rest of living creatures and beings, the ability and the want to preserve it. Okay, so that's the first precept. Now, if we're going to preserve life and prevent its destruction, there are certain sort of what we might call sub-laws which are going to flow from this. So what then are the goods which Aquinas would say we ought to be pursuing? If we're supposed to avoid evil and do good or pursue good, how do we do that under this precept? How do you stay alive? Not a trick question. It's not rhetorical either. Go ahead.
You can deserve your body,
Okay. Now, I like Chick-fil-A as much as anyone. What's going to happen if you eat at Chick-fil-A three times a day, except Sunday, and then try to live like that? What's that? It's processed food. It tastes good, but it's fried and it's processed. This is what happens when you eat Chick-fil-A and McDonald's three or four times a week for several years. It's what happened to me. I became overweight and out of shape. Now, thankfully, I use something else which helps counteract this a little bit, so I'm not a 500-pound blimp, which is another thing you have to do to preserve life, and that's exercise. We need exercise. Exercise would be the type of thing that Aquinas would call a good to pursue. What else do you do to stay alive? What about education? Does education preserve life? Ryan, you're nodding your head. Why? Or how?
It helps us learn and develop a bit of common sense and also understanding of the world.
Fair answer. I like the common sense part too. All right. You know, education helps us feel it. All right. Now, on the converse, the flip side of this, what are things which happen that we do other than the opposite of what we talked about? All right, eating Chick-fil-A six times a week, that's not going to preserve anyone's life. I mean, with all the preservatives it has in it, your body might be preserved, but you won't live. But what are some other things that would fall into the condemnation of this precept that are generally practiced culture-wide? Don't think too hard about this.
Drinking.
What's that?
Drinking.
Okay. How so?
Alcoholism.
Okay. Sure. Sure. You take a good alcohol. I mean, beer is how we know that God made us and loves us. And you turn it into an evil. You become intoxicated regularly. I mean, if you get behind a car wheel, you can actually kill someone doing that too. But I mean, yeah, it'll eventually kill you if you become an alcoholic. What else? All right, let's think of some really basic stuff here. What do we do to babies in this country? What's that? Abortion?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. This is one of the ways that we argue against abortion, because there is an instinct to life among living things, and it runs contrary to the natural law to take life unjustly. And so
Abortion absolutely falls under that category.
Euthanasia, we could say the same thing about. We can't take people's lives. We don't have that. We don't have that right. Just on a more basic level, murder. When we talk about the natural law, we're not talking about 10 commandments spelled out for us, or, you know, 60 bazillion of them that the U.S. government spells out for us. We're talking about basic principles. You can't take somebody else's life. You just can't do it in any form whatsoever. Okay, so that's precept number one. Here's the second one that Thomas spells out. We create life and we educate, I don't know why I wrote that over there, that didn't make any sense. We educate our young. We create life. We preserve the race of men. Animals do this too, with their own races, their own species. We naturally reproduce because we have an instinct that preserving our race is a good thing. So, let's get right into some of the problems that this precept would condemn. Homosexuality. How many of you know someone who's gay? Okay. How do you feel about that? Or better question, what do you think about that? Did you say something like that? Anyone?
Have you ever told that person that God disapproves of their lifestyle? Have you ever been able to say that to their face? Kind of hard. Did you ever tell them that it's a sin which not repented of can lead them to hell? It's kind of hard to say that. It's kind of hard to say that.
One of the things that I think the natural law can be very helpful in doing is to help open up a pathway to talk about some of these very difficult issues, which you will undoubtedly face if you haven't already. With the animal kingdom, we share the instinct and the inclination to create life. Homosexuality and homosexuals cannot do that. They can have sex, but they cannot create life. And that is the problem with it. And you need to be really careful, I think, in this regard, because one of the reasons why we lose the gay marriage debate, why we're losing it, is because we're talked about as unloving and intolerant people. That there must be something wrong with us to say that a loving God could ever hate anyone for anything. Okay? So, I think the natural law can help us if we talk about creating life as being one of the things which we are inclined to do and which our reason apprehends as good. We have a way of talking to people who are gay and saying in sort of a logical way to them, look, it's not that God is a killjoy. And it's not that we have any reason for you not to have friendships with people of your of the same sex as you are. But there's something unnatural about what you're doing. It's not unnatural because we think it's gross. It's unnatural because you can't create life with the actions you're doing. Okay? And sex, as we saw with the animals during mating season, or as we saw with the acorn that becomes the tree, sex has a proper end. Right? And one of them is to create life. And sex divorced from that is problematic. Any questions or problems with that? Go ahead.
I've heard the argument, not with evidence, but just in passing, that there's homosexuality in other species and is natural, so how would you respond to that?
I've only heard of one or two species. And someone else who knows something more about this
can answer this question if they know it. But it's extraordinarily rare. And the reason being is because the vast majority of creatures, other than humans, have sex for only one reason, and that's for procreation. Humans are different, and we can talk about that a little bit, but humans are really the creatures which, you know, have sex for a reason other than procreation. So whether or not that's actually true, I don't know, but still in the vast majority of occasions, the precept still holds. That's the reason why sex exists, is to propagate a species. That's a good question, though. Any other thoughts or questions? Yeah, go ahead.
I heard, that homosexuality contradicts the survival of the fittest. They believe that we evolve to where we become the dominant species. They think that homosexuality would stall that completely. You want to, you stay in order to go on, homosexuality would stop it.
So you've heard that as an argument against?
Well, I'm saying that it could be used for that. I mean, against evolution.
Okay. So that literally we can't survive if we don't procreate. Then. That's a good point. That's a good point. There's one other sort of subtopic, one other application I want to hit as a part of this creating life part. And it's one with which many of you and many of your parents may disagree with me about. But this is where the natural law might also point out to us the problems with contraception. Okay? Because by its definition, it tries to allow married couples, even married couples who are properly united as a one man and one woman, to have sex in which they're actively trying to thwart the natural process of creating life. So if you've ever heard someone say that contraception is opposed to the natural law, that's what they're saying when they point that out. That can open up a whole slew of questions. I don't want to spend a ton of time talking about that, but does anybody want to say anything about contraceptives as they relate to precept 2? Okay. Let's go on to the third precept. Humans have a natural inclination, which the reason calls good, to pursue truth and live in community. You notice that we talked a little bit about education up here when we talked about education as a good which helps preserve life. We didn't talk about much under the second precept, but that we do have an inclination to educate our young, whether it be in the animal kingdom, just how to defend yourself and how to get food, or in our own human existence, in how to best, you know, how to best make your mind open, and how to learn as many things as you can, and how to learn survival skills, but also how to just learn about God and all that He's created, and to become bright and things like that. Beyond this, we are to, in the third precept, pursue the truth. The best way to do this, according to Aquinas, is to live together in community. So, let me ask you this question. How does living together and not existing as a hermit best help us to pursue the truth?
Well,
why aren't we doing this 101? Why are there 15 to 20 of you in a classroom here?
It's greater in pairs or in big groups, it's always better than like bigger places.
But why is it better?
There's more people and you get the community and there's more people for it.
Okay, so there's more people. And if there are more people, then what are there more of? Okay, there are more ideas. We bring different backgrounds to even this discussion here. These backgrounds don't change that there are singular truths which we look at that are unchanging. Our own perspectives and feelings don't change things that are eternally true. But we can bring about different ways of looking at them, different ways of coming to grasp these truths as we may have experienced them. So certainly there's an advantage in at least some numbers when it comes to pursuing truth together. What else, what other goods does living in community afford for us? Why would it be better to be to live with people than not?
If something happens to you, somebody else can take care of you or vice versa.
Okay. Likely, there might be a doctor around. Or at least someone who knows CPR. You know, if you have a heart attack or just pass out or something like that. There's an advantage to not being alone in that case.
I feel like if you're living on your own, you're more self-indulged and you're more focused on yourself rather than as others around you.
Okay. So you learn to be selfish and not a giving person. Okay. You have more opportunities to be Christ-like when you live in community. Good. Anything else? Okay. Just think about defense. You know, when the British invaded the colonies, had the colonies chosen to be separate or even to go to a smaller unit, had each family that made up each colony decided to be separate, does the United States, quote unquote, do they win in the Revolutionary War? Probably not. They needed to band together to some degree in order to be able to pull that off. So there are advantages to living in community and pursuing truth within community. Thomas specifically says here also not to be ignorant toward other people and toward knowledge itself. For him, there was no excuse for being stupid. Okay? You have an obligation, because it's a natural inclination of man to learn things, to become smart, to become educated, to be able to have an adult conversation about eternal things and about unchanging things. You should be able to do that by the time you reach college and as you grow older. So we don't want to be ignorant. We want to pursue the truth. Does anybody else have anything they want to add to this third precept? Any goods that come from living in community, or any evils that could result from not living in community, other than you might collapse dead and there's nobody there to help you? There's another point to the natural law. I won't take much, much longer on this. But I want to answer the question of whether the natural law applies in all situations. We know from what Paul wrote to the Romans and the sort of test we saw with Lewis that there are laws we obey which come naturally, almost from somewhere within, that laws that are written in our hearts, and we obey them for our own good. Let's take this third precept again and talk about living in community just one step further. One of the subsets that Aquinas specifically mentions is that we should avoid offending those who we have to live in community with. Now let's further take this example. Stealing would be an offense to someone that you're around. Again, if I come back there and take Devin's notebook, I mean,
He's not going to be happy about that. I'm stealing from him. I'm offending him.
So there's a book which has become very popular again recently, and I suppose because of the musical recently released on film about it. But how many of you know the Victor Hugo's Les Miserables? Okay. What does Jean Valjean do in the story?
He steals bread.
Why? Okay. His sister's daughter, his niece, is starving to death. What was this, 1860s France, probably, I guess. His niece is starving to death, so he steals a loaf of bread. Now, according to what we've said about the natural law, offending somebody goes against the third precept of living in community. And stealing would be defined as offending somebody, broadly speaking. So, does Jean Valjean violate the natural law? Yeah, I haven't even finished the question yet. Did he violate the natural law in stealing the bread? Now go.
For the third precept, in a way, he's defending this guy, but he is trying to preserve his life to prevent his family's destruction.
Okay, so then the question becomes, does the natural law contradict itself? If he's trying to preserve life, which indeed he was trying to do, the girl was starving to death. Summer?
Well, the society wasn't going to be correct. Or he wouldn't be starving.
That's a wise answer. Why are they not living in community, or what would be living in community correctly? Well, how would that avoid that problem?
Yeah.
Well,
if everyone just shares their wealth, I guess,
so you're a socialist. You're not. And it's not communism either. It's not. It only becomes that if it becomes a government mandated system. Even then, to preserve life, I don't know. We have to talk about that a little bit more. But you're right. There isn't a true communal life going on there if there's someone within the community who's starving to death. If someone else has bread to spare, then it should be given to them. So that would be one way you might say the natural law wasn't being violated in that case. Another point you might make here, though, and it's a point that Aquinas makes in chapter 94 of Summa, is that he talks about, and this is where it gets back a little bit to Aristotle, he talks about our speculative reason. I'm not going to go into all what that means, but as being able to apprehend the natural law, we can, with our reason, understand these precepts. But when it comes down to it, when it comes down to individual situations, Aquinas exhorts us to use our practical reason, another term he borrows from Aristotle, our practical reason to guide our wills, to understand what might be best in a given situation. That doesn't mean throw the precepts of the natural law out the window. They're still binding on all men, really at all times. But there are times where practical reason has to intervene to understand that it isn't always cut and dry, so to speak. So he gives an example, another example that deals with stealing. And that is, what if you owe somebody money? How many of you owe someone or some entity money? Okay, what's your name?
Courtney.
Do you mind if I ask what entity you owe money to?
My dad.
Okay. Now, what if you found out, I owe my dad money too, so, what if you found out, and this is going to sound a little ridiculous, but what if you found out that your dad was planning on starting a war with the money you were going to repay him? Would it mean, yeah, I know, it sounds ridiculous. I was hoping you were going to say you owed money like to Sally Mae or something like that. But if you owe money to just someone who's going to start a war, you know that they intend to do this, would you repay that money to them?
Who's the war again?
Okay, what if they were going to try to set up an assassination attempt on your best friend with the money that you owed them? Would you repay the money?
No.
Okay, good. Good. Because even though the natural law tells us that it's wrong to steal, and withholding money you owe to someone is in essence stealing from them, if you're able to pay it and you don't, even though that would be against that precept, you have to use your practical reason, like I said, that's what he calls it, to understand that there may be situations like that where it doesn't make any sense for you to repay the loan. Alright. So, just to sort of wrap this up here a little bit, and then if we have any questions, we can go over them. What Jean Valjean did was not a violation of the natural law, in that it did preserve life, in that practical reason is sometimes necessary to discern in each situation. Actually, it's necessary in every situation, but it may not always line up precisely with the laws, the precepts we've talked about. Even though that's the case, the natural law, though, still stands. It's binding on all people, and it's binding on us because these are the natural inclinations toward which life, human, animal, other substances, is inclined. Because Aquinas saw that, because we can understand that, these are the general guidelines we must follow in order to end up, as the acorn does, as the oak tree, in order for us to end up at the good. This is how we avoid evil, and this is how we do good. So, does anybody have any thoughts or questions then about Aquinas and the natural law? We have a few minutes to talk about them. Is that a hand up or yes?
Is there a specific reason why number two is educate young instead of just educate in general?
Just because I think, we create life, it starts out young. Okay. And then at the earliest possible time, we begin to educate them.
So do you stop educating when no longer young? Or
no. This is why we continue to pursue truth as we live together in community. You should never stop your education. Education is definitely a good, that has a good end toward it. All right. Any other thoughts or questions? If not, can be.
Billy, I think it's important to throw in the idea when you ask, does one contradict three in an ethical dilemma? The ingredients of evil, because evil distorts truth, and therefore it makes it look like they contradict, but in reality, because of that ingredient of evil, by definition, distorting truth, it's going to look like it's contradicting what after all. It remains constant.
Right, and I think it was Isidore. Isidore wrote that, would it be a violation of natural law? And this sort of is where I got the example from Jean Valjean. He asked the question of whether or not somebody who stole from somebody else because of a need, and not need as Americans define need, as in they're going to die if they don't have this, was it a violation of the third precept here? And his argument was that God owns everything. That because it's all God's, and God would not want someone necessarily to starve to death, that the person who had should have given. This is, I think, what Summer you were getting at when you talked about sort of a true community, that you would not have people starving to death if you were actually living in real community. And so that if he's right, then yeah, absolutely. There's no contradiction here, but.
Could there be a contradiction if, like, the community is all poor and, like, one person has, like, just enough to feed their family and somebody else steals from them? Can that contradict?
Anybody want to weigh in on that before I do? That's a good question. What if everyone was poor and only one person had enough for their family?
Prevent its destruction, number one. So,
what's that?
Well, number one, it says prevent its destruction, so I guess they're not all going to die, so some will die.
So start picking out who gets to live. That's a tough question.
Would you like to?
I would.
Weigh in on that?
Each man has to work inside out. Your first responsibility is to your family, and then you work your way out to your neighbor. And so, if a man has a loaf of bread and he's starving like everybody else, his responsibility is to his family. And then, if you have more, you can then extend that. But that's your first responsibility.
I would generally agree with that. And I mean, I think also William, as a future head of the house, your responsibility is to actually your family, not to yourself first. And if there's any way you can yourself, whatever little you can get away with giving, to give that away before you take it to yourself.
So then in that situation, the person who's stealing bread, would he be in the wrong? Is he trying to give his family?
Yes, he would. If everybody is starving and one family has it, and I say, well, I want to preserve the life of my own, so I'm going to take from them, yes, that would be a violation of natural law.
It's a tough situation to envision because in the society in which we live, I mean, there literally is so much. I mean, we pay farmers not to grow corn in our society, which is just a whole other problem we could talk about another day. It's hard for us to envision. When we talk about poverty in the United States, we don't even come close to understanding what poverty actually looks like.
But still, it's a good question. I mean,
unfortunately, in our culture, if you ask that question, I mean, the answer really is, well, that other family needs to head down to their local government office and get some kind of assistance. And that's the answer to that question here. So it's kind of hard for us to really envision that happening. But it's still a good question. Anything else?
We're going to have 15 minutes. So,